And if I can help through my life create a world in which we look at the rest of the animals on this planet as existing with us, not merely for us, I will think that my life will have been very well lived.
My name is Leigh Farnason. My brother Anders and I are on a mission to help 1 million vegans get into the best shape of their lives. We firmly believe that the more healthy and fit vegans there are in the world, the faster veganism will spread. Let's work together to inspire change, spread compassion, and challenge the status quo. Welcome to the Vegan Gym Podcast. Hey, what's going on? My name is Leigh Farnason, and in this episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with Paul Shapiro. Paul Shapiro is the author of the national bestseller, Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. He's also the CEO of the Better Meat Co., a four-time TEDx speaker, the host of the Business for Good podcast, and a longtime leader in food sustainability. The company Paul co-founded and runs, the Better Meat Co., uses fermentation to turn microbes into meat within hours, creating a far more sustainable and humane method of satisfying our world's, quote, meat tooth than raising and slaughtering animals for food. I really enjoyed my conversation with Paul, and I hope you do as well. So you've been vegan for over 30 years, or I guess you just came up on 30 years. You went vegan in 1993. You were a vice president at the Humane Society for over a decade. You're currently running a cutting edge vegan meat company. You have tons of experience with promoting a message of health and compassion and veganism. So what key lessons have you learned from about kind of effective vegan advocacy?
Oh, you know, it's such an interesting question, Leigh. First, it's great to be with you. Great to be chatting and great to be talking with a fellow vegan gym goer. Like so much of my social life, like actually, you're interested, like a lot of my social life used to be work. Like I hung out with the people at work, and now most of my social life is like people I've met at the gym. So it's an interesting thing where many of the people in my world were vegan. Now many of them aren't. So it's an interesting transition. But anyway, I know that's not what you're asking me. So the first question, Leigh, let me just put it to you this way. When I became vegan, I had what I could jokingly refer to as like new veganitis, which is where, you know, you're extremely angry, right? You learn about all the horrible things that humans are doing to animals, and you just can't believe that people are complicit in this. And, you know, you think, well, of course, I'll just show them what's happening and they'll change. But most people don't. And so you become very angry. And so I did a lot of advocacy that felt justifiable to me. Like it felt good. Like it was like kind of like self-righteous activism. Like, you know, I got arrested and doing civil disobedience. And I'm not knocking any of that, but I question how much of an impact for animals it actually had, like whether anybody actually, you know, decided to stop eating animals or stop going to the animal-based circuses or stop wearing fur and et cetera. Maybe some, but I would doubt many. And over time, I came to a place where it became clear to me that it was not just important to be right. You have to be right, but you also have to be effective. And being effective means being pragmatic. And it's very obvious to me that, you know, for example, persuading people to cut down on half of their meat consumption is a lot easier than persuading them to go whole hog or really no hog, right? And so if you persuade two people to become vegetarian half the time, from the animal's perspective, it's really the same thing as one person all the time. And it might be more easy. And so you know, my message really shifted from one that I would say was a little bit more strident to one that is a little bit more encouraging of any progress. So if people want to do Meatless Mondays, or they want to do like what Mark Bittman, the cookbook author, does, which is, says he's vegan before 6 p.m. and then after 6 p.m. he eats whatever he wants. Or you can do what I do, which is vegan before 6 p.m. and vegan after 6 p.m. You can just be vegan all the time. You know, I think that we should celebrate progress and encourage progress rather than demand perfection. And I don't even think there is such a thing as perfection. Like even people who self-identify as vegan are still causing all types of animal suffering from a variety of things that we do on a day-to-day basis. So I don't think we should pretend like there's some state of perfection out there. Rather, I think we should just try to do the best that we can and encourage others to do the same in a loving, open, kind way. And so that's been a big change. And then finally, I would say, I used to really think that change was going to happen. People were going to see the benefits of plant-based eating and switch, whether it be health, environment, animals. And in, you know, the last, last like 7 or 8 years, I've really come around to the point of view that the reasons that motivate people to choose certain foods really are not animal welfare. They're not environment. They're usually not even health. You know, most people eat foods because they like the way they taste and because they're affordable for them. And so when people say, oh, you know, why should you become vegan? And vegans will usually say, oh, it's better for you, it's better for the planet, it's better for animals. But if you look at the factors that actually drive most dietary choices, those are not, those three reasons are not even in the top five. They're not even in the top 10 a lot of the times. So it's really important for us to compete on taste and on price with the products. And that is one of the things I've been really enthusiastic about with food technology lately, to see companies that are getting better and better on taste. And they're still not competing on cost, but they're getting closer. And that's really important. And so I became very convinced that food technology was a very promising way to help reduce the number of animals used for food. And we can talk more about that later. But another shift in my viewpoint, really within the last 8 or so years, as to, you know, what will help animals the most. None of us really know. We should have some humility in that. But I think the history of what has displaced animal exploitation before is very clear. It's usually technology. It's usually not humane sentiment. You know, we used to whip horses to get around. Now we bike and drive, not because anybody cared about horses, but because these are better ways to transport ourselves. You know, we used to harpoon whales to light our homes. Now we don't, because we have electricity. And, you know, so nobody stopped harpooning whales because they cared about whales. They stopped because we didn't need whale oil anymore. We could light our homes with better, more newer technologies. You know, we used to have to live plug geese in order to write. You know, now we tap on glass screens in order to write, but we live plucked geese for thousands of years in order to write. And nobody stopped live plucking geese because they cared about geese. They stopped because a new technology, metal fountain pens, were invented. And that enabled us a much more efficient way to write than quills did. And so what my book, Clean Meat, and my company, The Better Meat Co., are really all about is this idea that technology can help animals. It's not the only thing, but it's a very promising way to help animals, and it's done a lot for them in many respects so far.
I love that whole answer, and I love how your perspective has shifted over these past few decades in terms of vegan advocacy and what you can do to help the animals, help the planet. So yeah. One of my next questions was, how was the idea for the Better Meat Company born? And it sounds like it was born out of this understanding, realization that technology is really the driving force behind change. So is that accurate?
Yeah, I'd say it's a driving force. You know, look, there are some examples where demand for a certain product actually did decline due to animal welfare concerns. So veal, for example, really in the 1980s, there was a big campaign arguing why people shouldn't eat veal for animal welfare reasons only. And it really precipitously plummeted. The demand for veal precipitously plummeted. So that's an example where an animal welfare message actually did have a major impact on a particular industry. Now, did it actually save animals, though? I mean, I think it's pretty unlikely that people were swapping veal for tofu, right? They're probably switching veal for beef or chicken or turkey. And so it is an example that with at least a, you know, high-end, rarely eaten product, then an animal welfare message might shift consumption away from it. Whether it actually ended an industry, that's another matter altogether. But when you think about, you know, just, you know, think about just, you know, let's say the whaling industry as an example to go back to that. You know, whaling was the primary way that we lit our homes for centuries. Whaling was a huge part of the colonial economy in what was before the United States, and a huge part of the early United States economy as well. You know, a huge portion of laborers worked on whaling ships. And, you know, you even had like massive whaling ports. And yet, if you look back to when kerosene was first patented in the early 1850s, and then you fast forward over the next couple decades, whaling boats were decimated by about 90%. 90% less whaling than had happened for centuries. Not because people didn't want to light their homes anymore, not because anybody cared about whales, not because people wanted to conserve or be sustainable, only because kerosene was a cheaper, more efficient, cleaner way to light our homes. And then eventually electricity displaced kerosene lamps. And so it's a great example of how animals benefited. And this is what I write about in my book, Clean Meat, which is that so often we care about animals once we stop exploiting them. it's a lot easier for us to care about whales when we no longer are dependent on the exploitation of whales. My wife and I recently went whale watching, and you know, I was thinking, if this had been 150 years ago, the idea that people would pay to get on a boat merely to look at whales would have been totally insane to these people. Like, they couldn't even imagine it. And yet now whale watching is a major industry. And the same is so with so many other types of animal exploitation. Think about horse-drawn carriages, which, you look at the history of the American animal welfare movement, it really was the horse-drawn carriages that were the big impetus to start this movement. Back in the 1860s, the abuse of horses was so savage in the streets of New York and Boston and Philadelphia that the very first animal welfare societies got founded in the late 1860s and 1870s, primarily for the purpose of trying to protect horses. And so you had people like Henry Berg, the founder of the ASPCA, who waged all these campaigns in the late 1860s and 1870s to try to get horses a better lot. He wanted mandatory resting hours for the horses so they couldn't be worked 24/7. He wanted Sabbath days for the horses so they could have one day off a week. He wanted watering stations for the horses so that they could not have to wait until the end of the day to drink water. And yet, in the end, it was not Henry Berg who did everything for horses. It was Henry Ford. You know, Henry Ford ended up liberating horses through the, basically popularizing cars, or what were originally back then called horseless carriages. And yet Henry Ford didn't care about horses at all. And nobody who used horseless carriages cared about horses. You know, it wasn't like anybody was out there saying, hey, don't ride horses. Even the animal welfare advocates weren't arguing that you shouldn't ride horses or use horses for transportation. And so time and time again, what we see is technology displacing animal exploitation, not humane sentiment. And now, that's not an argument against making a humane concern. Obviously, we should. I mean, that's what motivated me to become vegan in the first place. It is what has motivated so many other people I know. But for the most part, you don't see a lot of industries ending because of it. And so the topic of my book, Clean Meat, really explores what happens when we stop using animals. And I would argue that people care about the animals after we stop using them. So many people think, oh, we get people to care about animals, then they'll stop using them. But the reality is that people generally start caring about them after we're done using them. And so now we have, whale watching industries. Now we think of horses more as companion animals rather than labor animals. Nobody thinks about geese as, some animal to be exploited for their quills anymore, for the most part, because we don't need their quills. So we have a different view. And I think, you know, there's a saying that it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. And I think that's, you know, what's happening here, that there's less cognitive dissonance once we're no longer dependent on the exploitation of a species of animal. Then we can start thinking about them differently, start recognizing that, you know, for example, chickens and turkeys and pigs and cows are sensitive, intelligent individuals who deserve our respect. And we can accept that because it no longer causes us so much cognitive dissonance. We don't have to think, oh, these animals, I'm causing them so much suffering. Nobody wants to think that. So my company, The Better Meat Co., to answer your question directly, Leif, is basically trying to do the two things that I mentioned earlier, which is to compete both on taste and on price, which is to create even more meat-like products in a way that costs even less. It's a very hard thing to do, but we are doing it. We're doing it through microbial fermentation. So I'm happy to talk all about that, of course, but that's the reality of what we're trying to do, is basically figure out, how do you create the meat experience without animals? We know there's lots of different ways to create, let's say, energy without fossil fuels, like wind, solar, geothermal, et cetera. Lots of ways to create energy without fossil fuels. And there's lots of ways to create meat without animals. And we're doing one type. You know, we're not doing plant proteins. We're not doing animal cell culture. We're doing microbial fermentation of fungi. And that is a difficult thing, but it's worth trying.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you just brought up a kind of really good transition point to my next question, which is, there are essentially three types of protein alternatives to meat. So you have the plant-based, cultured, and fermented. So could you please explain the differences between those products?
Sure. So think about it, just like I was saying, you know, you got solar, wind, and geothermal, right? They all are very different technologies, but they're aiming to do the same thing, to create energy so that you can heat your home or light your home without having to use fossil fuels. And, you know, these so-called renewables, these renewables, you know, they don't emit fossil fuel. They don't emit like CO2 in the way that fossil fuels do when you combust them. So all of that said, think about plant proteins in the following way. You know, right now, if you eat a Beyond Burger, which is a great product, I like eating them. But the hero ingredient is pea protein. And it's not just any pea protein, it's texturized pea protein. What that means is that you have to grow a field of peas, harvest the field of peas, mill it into a flour. Now you have a pea flour. It's very low in protein, though. So you got to strip out the fiber and strip out the fat and concentrate that protein source down. So now you have a pea protein concentrate or even a pea protein isolate that would be used by, like, you know, a weightlifter to put on mass, right? The problem is that pea protein powder doesn't have the texture of meat. So you now have a high protein product that's like meat, but you don't have the texture of meat because plants have globular proteins, molecularly speaking, whereas animals have stringy proteins. So if you wanted to have the texture of animal meat, you have to convert that globular protein into a stringy protein. And the most common way of doing that is called extrusion. It's basically a fancy way of saying lots of pressure and lots of heat. And what you do is through the extrusion process, you change that pea protein powder into something that is texturized. It puffs out and it creates a stringy type of protein. So now you're more doing a better job of mimicking animal meat. That texturized pea protein becomes the top ingredient in your Beyond Burger. There are other ingredients you have to add to it to also flavor and get other meat-like texture, but still, that's the basic premise of it. So that's option one, is basically taking plants and converting them into something that looks and tastes like animal meat. The problem is plants and animals are really far apart, evolutionarily speaking. So it's not surprising that plants don't have the texture of animal meat because the plant's flesh is very different from animal's flesh. So some people were then thinking, okay, well, instead of using plant protein isolates, let's instead just use actual animal cells, but without the animals. And so that's a technology known as cultivated meat or clean meat. It's what, again, what the topic of my book, Clean Meat, is about. But essentially what you're doing there is growing real actual animal cells, but you're doing it outside of the animal's body. These products are not in the market in the United States. You cannot go out and buy them, and it's going to be a long time before they are available on fast food menus or on big box grocery store shelves for a variety of reasons. It's just really expensive to do. It's not scaled up. There's just a lot of reasons why there's a bottleneck there. So as bullish as I am on cultivated meat as an option, I don't think that it's going to displace animal meat anytime soon because it just takes so much. You know, the biggest factories that are currently envisioned right now, not even built, but still being designed, for the cultivated meat side, they're arguing, well, they'll probably produce about 30 million pounds of meat a year. So, you know, you think about that, it sounds like a lot, but, you know, there's over 100 billion pounds of meat produced in the United States every single year. So a 30 million pound factory sounds big, but it's not even close to 1% of all the meat demand out there. So it's going to take a long time before cultivated meat is making any real dent in the number of animals who are being used for food. But there is a third way. And we were talking about it earlier, and yes, I am talking about the F word, fungi. And so, you know, this third way of using fungi offers some real benefits. And I'm not talking about mushrooms here, because mushrooms, while many mushrooms do have a kind of meat-like texture, they don't have much protein. So it's limited in its applicability to making it as a meat alternative because people really want protein. So I'm not talking about mushrooms. I'm talking about mycelium, which is the filamentous root-like structure that blankets much of the earth. Most of the time when you walk outside, you walk on the ground, you're compressing some type of mycelium underneath your feet. And so mycelium is oftentimes far more meat-like than plants or mushrooms. And it makes sense because if you think about evolutionarily speaking, go back to the tree of life. Again, plants and animals are really far apart, but fungi are a different kingdom altogether. And they're not close to plants. They're way closer to animals. Fungi are much closer to animals than they are to plants. So just think about it biologically, like, you know, we know that we animals have to breathe in oxygen, breathe out CO2. Plants do the opposite. They breathe in CO2, they breathe out oxygen. Well, fungi are so much closer to animals that they too breathe in oxygen, they breathe out CO2. Similarly, we know plants just put themselves in the sun and they photosynthesize, that's how they eat, whereas animals and fungi have to go out and find their food and digest it. So it shouldn't be surprising that mushrooms is a meat alternative for centuries because many mushrooms have a far more meat-like texture than do plants. Again, though, mushrooms aren't very high in protein, and they are also not perfectly meat replicates. You know, they are more meat-like, but they're not a perfect, you know, nobody's going to eat a portobello mushroom and mistakenly think that they're eating animal meat. And so what we do at the Better Meat Co. is work with mycelium. Mycelium is the whole unprocessed root-like structure that goes underneath ground that's comprised of fungi. And what we do is basically run a fermentation process. It looks like a beer brewery, except it's instead of brewing alcohol, we're brewing protein. And so we take tiny microscopic fungi and we subject them to a special kind of fermentation that within less than one single day converts them into a food that naturally, in its whole food, unprocessed state, comes out of the fermenter with a meat-like texture, with that stringy filamentous protein, and on its own, without any additional fortification, it comes out higher in protein than eggs, higher in iron and zinc than beef, higher in potassium than bananas, higher in fiber than oats, and it naturally contains vitamin B12, which is typically lacking in plant-based foods because it's a product of microbial fermentation. So again, to recap, in less than a single day, we go from a tiny little amount of microscopic fungi to filling a fermenter with a product that has a meat-like texture and has all the nutrition of meat that you want, protein, zinc, iron, and so on, but without the things about meat that you don't want. No saturated fat, no cholesterol, no animal cruelty, and so on. And so that's what we're doing at the Better Meat Co., is essentially trying to create a new generation of meat alternatives that are not based on plant protein isolates, that are not based on animal cell culture, but rather are based on microbial fungi fermentation. And this is a scalable, economic way to produce animal-free meat. And we are based in Sacramento. The company now has 25 people working here. When I co-founded the company 5 years ago, it was obviously just an idea. Now we have 25 people and a production facility where we have a three-story tall fermenter, churning out a river of microbial protein that is delicious. People love it. And now we need to start building fermenters that are more like the size of office buildings and actually start making a dent in the amount of meat that's consumed in the world.
Awesome. Yeah, that was a great overview. I want to get into more detail about the exact work that you're doing. But before we move on from the kind of three different types of protein alternatives, I would like to just touch on cultured meat for one other question. Besides eliminating diseases like salmonella, are there any other health benefits to cultured meat versus regular meats? I didn't really get a clear answer on that from my research online.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, you know, one of the reasons why many people call it clean meat is because it is cleaner. Yeah, it's an illusion of clean energy, but it is cleaner. So think about it. You mentioned salmonella, but also, you know, Campylobacter, E. coli, salmonella, these are all intestinal pathogens that can sicken us if we don't cook the crap out of the meat. Literally, you're literally cooking the crap out of the meat. Well, with clean meat, you don't have to worry so much about intestinal pathogens because you're not dealing with intestines at all. You're just dealing with animal cells. And so you're more likely to infect the meat with your filthy hands than it is to infect you. And so, you know, right now you go to the supermarket, you have to treat raw meat like toxic waste. You know, they tell you don't let it touch your other groceries, put it in a different plastic bag. It comes home. If it touches your counter, you got to disinfect the counter. I mean, you know, you don't have to do that with a zucchini, right? And that's because, you know, zucchini didn't have intestines. And so there's likely not fecal pathogens on it in the way there is on much of the raw meat that is out there. Now, all of that said, there are other benefits though, in addition to the cleanliness of the product, mainly that you can create meat that is better than what the animal creates. So for example, imagine a future in which you could grow meat that instead of saturated fat, actually was rich in omega-3 fatty acids. So instead of a hamburger that causes heart attacks, maybe you'd have one that prevents heart attacks. You know, that doesn't exist today, but theoretically you could envision it happening. So there's a lot of benefits when you can control what's in the meat. Right now, it's very difficult to get a cow to do anything different. You know, you might be able to have some feed additives that modify the nutrition of the meat in some limited ways, but not like when you have total control over everything that's going in and out of that cultivator.
Yeah, so that's cultured meat. But to get back to the product that you're working on, just for the benefit of our listeners, I want to run through all those amazing facts that you shared about the better meat you're making again. So your meat is higher in protein than eggs. It's higher in iron and zinc than beef. It's higher in fiber than oats. It's higher in potassium than bananas. It contains B12. It's high in polyphenols, which have antioxidant properties. It's a complete protein containing all essential amino acids, and the entire fermentation process from microscopic fungi, as you said, to meat happens in a single day. That last one might be the most mind-blowing, at least for me. What are some misconceptions that people have about fermented meat, and how are you working to overcome those?
A lot of the time when people hear the word fermented, they think sour, right? Because they're thinking about things like sauerkraut or beer. But there's lots of different types of fermentation. Like fermentation is a technology that's used to make a huge number of foods that are not the things that people think of. Like, you know, they're thinking about like kombucha, or they're thinking about wine or beer and so on. Whereas we're doing a very different kind of fermentation, you know? So think about like, let's say with beer, what you're doing is essentially taking a microorganism, in this case, brewer's yeast is the, you know, the colloquial name for it. And you're feeding it sugar. It consumes the sugar and it excretes alcohol. That's what it does. Like, that's what beer is, right? It's just the alcohol that is produced through a yeast that has eaten the sugar. And so you're not really so much after the yeast as much as you are after the excretion of the yeast, in this case, alcohol. Similarly, if you take a different type of yeast called baker's yeast and you, you know, put it into bread, it consumes the sugars in the flour and it produces CO2. And that's why you get the bread rising. And so the little bubbles in the bread are from the brewer's yeast, the baker's yeast, which are producing CO2 to leaven your bread. That's why if you don't have yeast in your bread, it's not going to rise. And so these are types of fermentations where you're using the microorganism essentially as a factory to produce the product that you want, in these cases, alcohol or CO2. What we're doing is very different. We're not using microorganisms to get them to produce something else. We're raising the microorganisms for the microorganisms. It's kind of like the difference between feeding a chicken so you can get eggs or feeding a chicken so you can eat the chicken. Although in our case, we can grow our microorganisms in, again, less than a single day, whereas, you know, a chicken takes, over 40 days before they reach slaughter weight, and cows take well over a year of feeding them before they reach slaughter. Yeah, we harvest our microbes in less than a single day. So it's really among the most efficient ways to produce protein on the planet. And it makes sense because, generally speaking, the larger the organism, the longer it takes to reproduce. So you think about like, you know, a cow takes a long time to make other cows. A pig takes a little bit less time to make other pigs. Chickens, even faster. You get down to like rats and mice. They can produce new rats and mice very rapidly. But when you get down to the microbial level, you're talking about replication times in the hours, not the days, not the weeks, not the months, not the years, but really in the hours. And that's how we can produce so much protein. Now, if we were just producing protein, that would be one thing. You can make protein powders out of it, and that's fine. But the real key benefit of what we're doing is that we're producing protein that naturally, in its whole food, unprocessed state, already is textured like animal meat. And that is this revolutionary idea where you don't have to engage in fractionation, isolation, extrusion, all the things you got to do to plants to make them meat-like. We can just do it merely through fermentation.
You mentioned protein powder. Is this a process that any companies are currently using to create protein supplements as well?
No. The protein powders that are on the vegan market are pretty much universally soy protein or pea protein. Sometimes to get a better, more complete protein, they'll add like quinoa or pumpkin seed protein in small amounts just to make up for like lysine or some of the other, or leucine, which are, you know, oftentimes limited in some of the vegan products. To my knowledge, nobody is making a protein powder out of this type of a fermentation process. There are some folks who are fermenting pea protein powder to make it more palatable, but they're not selling you the microbes. They're selling you the pea protein powder.
Right. So yeah, that does seem maybe like a little bit of a untapped market, or maybe has some potential from a commercial perspective.
Yeah, I think
I've never heard of.
I think it could be a good business. You know, for me, the goal is to displace animals in the supply chain, right? So, like, I don't want to displace pea protein out there. Like, it's not a big benefit. So, I mean, I think what we're doing is better than pea protein, but it's not something that I'm going to devote my life to. You know, the animating force of my life for decades has been how can we reduce the amount of violence that we're committing against animals. And so for me, like, even though there's lots of applications for what we're doing, like we could make a flour out of it and make a bread, you make high protein breads, but, you know, I don't care if it displaces wheat, you know, I'm trying to displace meat. So anyway, a protein powder that displaces whey protein would have that effect. If it just displaced like, you know, other pea proteins, I'm not sure it'd be really worth at least my time to do it. But I would take it. If somebody else did it, I would certainly buy it. I'd be thrilled, actually.
Cool. All right. So you've touched on kind of your personal mission in a few different ways so far during our conversation. Your business partner, Donnie, she loves to ask people who apply to work at your company, the Better Miko, what impact do you want to make in the world? And I'd love to turn that question on you and ask you, what impact are you really working to make in the world?
So I love that Donnie asks that of our applicants, and it's something that I always want to make sure of, that folks have at least some level of mission alignment with what we're trying to do, because what we're doing is hard. This isn't an easy process. It's not an easy thing to do. Running your own company, it's always difficult. I have a lot of respect for people who start their own companies. Most of them will fail. 90% of startups that get started ultimately fail. So it's a very, people think, oh, you're going to go into it because you want, money or glory or whatever. Chances are you're actually going to get fame and heartache. You're going to get failure and heartache. I have a lot of respect for folks who do that. But I'll tell you, to answer your question directly, Leif, I view my life as essentially a service where I'm trying to create a better world, where I want the world to have less suffering than it would have had I existed. I was at my cousin's funeral. Sadly, she was 42 years old. She died of cancer. I went to her funeral and I was listening. It's about a year ago. I was listening to people eulogize her. And I was thinking, I'm the same age as her. So now I'm 43. But at the time I was 42, she was 42. And, I was thinking it could have been me in that casket. And what would I want said about me? What would I have achieved in my life if I were the one who is being eulogized? Probably the only thing I would care about is that the world had been a better place because I had lived, that there was less suffering and more happiness in the world because I had existed. Now, we're causing suffering all the time. We're causing suffering every time, we drive or fly or hurt somebody's feelings, whatever it is, we're causing suffering all the time. And so you really have to get on top of that equation by actively trying to alleviate suffering. It's not enough just to try to reduce the amount of suffering you're causing, which I think is important. But it's also really important to try to alleviate suffering in the world, not just to minimize the suffering you personally cause, but to try to go out there and alleviate other forms of suffering. And that's what I'm seeking to do. That's what I want to do through my life's work, is to create a world in which our relationship with our fellow creatures on this planet is no longer one that's based merely on violence and domination, as it has been for so long, but rather one that's based on compassion and respect. And trust me, I know that sounds very lofty. It sounds impossible to imagine a relationship between humans and other animals that is no longer based on us dominating them. But lots of things have seemed impossible until they were done. If you look even at our own society in the United States, like let's just say 150 years ago, the legitimate social debate back then was whether one person should be able to own another person. And 150 years ago, you could be a respectable member of society and advocate for human slavery. You'd be a doctor, a lawyer, a member of Congress, and hold that position. It was a controversial view, but it was controversial because people were on both sides of it. And today, of course, if you took the position in favor of human slavery, you would be ostracized. You would probably lose your job. Your partner would leave you. You wouldn't have any friends. Like, it would be complete social ruin. And so thankfully today, people recognize that human slavery is an abomination. But for thousands of years, it wasn't. For thousands of years, it wasn't perceived that way. The Greeks, the Egyptians, the Romans, they all had slaves. Even the greatest, the people who, really developed Western philosophy, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, perceived as being some of the greatest thinkers ever. Well, they never, ever wrote about slavery. Never even crossed their mind to write that there might be something wrong with it. It's in the Bible, it's throughout society. And so 150 years ago, we had a society where you could be a respectable member of society and believe in human slavery. And today, you can't do that anymore. Even 100 years ago, the legitimate social debate was whether half the population ought to be able to vote. Whether women should vote. Well, you could be a respectable member of society and say women shouldn't be able to vote. 100 years ago. 50 years ago, we were still debating whether whites and blacks ought to be able to share the same drinking fountain. And that you could be a respectful member of society on either side of that issue back then. Today, if you take the wrong view on any of these, if you're for racial segregation or you're against women's suffrage, you're for human slavery, you're going to be ostracized. If you came out, imagine if you went out and posted on Facebook that you thought women shouldn't be able to vote or that we should have different drinking fountains for different races. You would be disowned by everybody who likes you, basically. Yet a blink of an eye ago, historically speaking, those are normal social views to hold. And so I wonder, what will our descendants think in the future about our behaviors today. It's so easy for us to look back and say, oh, how could they ever have held these views? You know, what barbarians? Yet, they were normal views to hold back then. Today, a normal view to hold is that animals exist merely for us. Not that they exist with us, but they exist for us. Whereas in the future, I think that people are going to look back and they're going to be pretty horrified by how we treated animals in our era. And if I can help through my life create a world in which we look at the rest of the animals on this planet as existing with us, not merely for us, I will think that my life will have been very well lived. Just in the same way that like Copernicus and Galileo helped us to understand that we are not the center of the physical universe, I think that it's time for us to recognize that maybe we're not the center of the moral universe either. But maybe the other animals with whom we share this planet deserve some amount of respect and dignity from us, rather than just being viewed as commodities for us to exploit however we may wish. And I want my life to be part of the creation of that type of a society where we no longer view ourselves as sitting on some throne above everybody else, but we have a more humble, more realistic view of ourselves in which we try to live in more harmony with the rest of the world than we currently do.
That was beautifully said. Thank you for, I love how you draw on kind of historical changes and models to understand the world that we're living in and heading into, and how we might be viewing consuming animals in a similar way to these other historical atrocities. So you wrote a national best-selling book titled Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. And in your book, you quote the billionaire entrepreneur Richard Branson, who stated, "I believe that in 30 years or so, we will no longer need to kill any animals, and that all meat will either be clean or plant-based, taste the same, and also be much healthier for everyone. One day, we will look back and think how archaic our grandparents were in killing animals for food," which is exactly kind of the what you're touching on in kind of your mission and what you were just stating. However, meat consumption per capita, as you pointed out, is currently increasing in the U.S. It's increasing in the world, and the number of people in the world are also increasing. How do you view these different trends changing over time? Like, what is the future of meat, and how are these trends going to, where do things end up?
Yeah, it's a great point. And, you know, I love that quote from Richard Branson, may it come true. But, you know, look at it this way. If you live in a vegan bubble, and maybe some people who listen to the Vegan Gym podcast might, you think that everything is going in the right direction. You see plant-based meat is popping up in fast food restaurants, and, you know, on your social media, you see all these people and celebrities going vegan. But let me just assure you, I'm sad to say, I wish it weren't true, but meat demand is going up, not down. And it's not just going up because there's more humans on the planet, though that's a big part of it. It's going up on a per person basis also. So per capita today, we eat more meat than we ever have in all of human history. In the United States, that is true. Today, we eat more meat per person, not just because there's more people, but on a per person basis, we're eating more meat than ever before. So we should not delude ourselves into thinking, oh, the world is going vegan. I assure you, that's not happening right now. And the places where it's going to matter the most in the future, China, India, Brazil, where the biggest, you know, populations are, meat demand is skyrocketing. And so right now, you know, presuming that there's no change in the projections, the number of animals who are going to be needed for food will at least double. And so the question is, how can we satiate humanity's meat tooth without doing that? You know, how can we create a world where people can enjoy the experience of eating meat that they really crave, while at the same time not relying on animals? You know, the statistics are very sobering, very sobering. Not only is meat demand going up on a per person basis and on a raw basis because of added human population, but, you know, you don't see like even a massive increase in the number of vegetarians or vegans. And part of the reason is attrition. You know, the studies show that generally between 8 to 9 out of 10 people who go vegetarian stop being vegetarian. There are dramatically more former vegetarians than there are current vegetarians. And so, you know, I hate to be like a Debbie Downer, but, you know, the sad thing is we have to accept the world as it is. We have to play the cards as they're dealt rather than playing the hand that we want. I wish we had a royal flush, but we have like a pair of twos basically. So if that. So we've got a situation where meat demand is going up. It's projected to keep on rising. So what are we going to do? Are we going to just keep doing what hasn't been working, which is telling people about the ethical benefits of vegetarian eating? You know, I think I don't dislike that, but it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient. I think it's a good message. I agree with it, but it's not sufficient to actually change the world. And so the way that we're going to do this is by creating meat alternatives that are cheaper than animal meat. It's just the same thing with clean energy. We're not going to switch to solar and wind unless they are cheaper than oil and gas. That's just the way it is. You know, even people who are environmentalists, who are concerned about climate change, are generally speaking not going to change unless it's cost effective for them to do so. That's why the vast overwhelming majority of cars still sold today are regular internal combustion engine cars. Now, electric and hybrid are growing, but they're still a very small part of the market. And meat alternatives today, even in the U.S., which is the biggest market for meat alternatives in the world, it's like a rounding error. It's like a rounding error. You know, right now, plant-based milks are about 15% of the fluid milk market in the U.S. Plant-based meats, less than 1%. Less than 1% of the volume of meat that is sold is plant-based. So we have a long way to go. And it basically means dramatic leaps in technology that will allow us to produce excellent tasting meat alternatives that are cheaper than animal meat. That, in my view, is the pathway toward actually reversing the projections of dramatic increases needed in the number of animals used.
So after that sobering overview, what kind of inspirational message do you have for vegans who are watching this who want to make a difference and help promote this message?
That it can be done. You know, the rate of conversion to solar and to wind is dramatic, way faster than people thought was going to be possible. And part of that is because of government incentives. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act that was just passed and signed by President Biden is going to even further accelerate a move away from fossil fuels. And that's what we need. Like, if we are serious about wanting to reduce our reliance on animals for food, we need government incentives to help us to do that. That means R&D money. That means low interest loans so we can build manufacturing facilities and a whole variety of other government incentives that can help to convert away from a protein industry based on animal slaughter to one that's based on microbes or plants or animal cell culture. So, but it can happen. And organizations like the Good Food Institute, which is a nonprofit organization that works on this issue, and another one called Food Solutions Action, another nonprofit organization, are working to do just that. And they're starting to succeed. So Tufts University recently got a $10 million federal grant to focus on cultivated meat. UC Davis, near where I am in Sacramento, got a $2.5 million grant to focus on cultivated meat. The Canadian government is really putting a lot into plant proteins. Even just this week, you know, we're recording this in March of 2023, and the Danish government just announced that in order for them to meet Denmark's climate goals, it will require the Danes to consume two-thirds less meat than they currently do on a per-person basis. Two-thirds less meat. And so they're going to try to do that and try to move toward that type of a system. To go back, though, I misspoke and said the Dutch. Well, interestingly, the Dutch are now, for climate purposes and environmental purposes, paying farmers to raise fewer animals. They're just paying them to raise fewer animals. You look at this there are lots of examples of agricultural transitions that have occurred, and it does require some type of government incentives, though. Look at what happened with tobacco, right? Like, there's huge government pressure to move away from tobacco growing. And so they created programs to teach tobacco growers how to grow other things. Amusingly, one of them was chickpeas, because as demand for smoking went down, demand for hummus went up. They're not causally correlated, but they were temporally correlated. And so there was programs to basically help tobacco growers switch to chickpea growing because demand for chickpeas is going way up. That's really cool. Well, we should be doing the same thing, right? Like, the people who are currently farming chickens could be instead farming the peas that are needed to make Beyond Burgers, the soybeans needed to make Impossible Burgers, the sugars that are needed to feed microbes to grow the types of proteins that we at the Better Meat Co. grow. You still need an agricultural system, right? Like, it's not like we're creating food from nothing. But it's a lot more efficient, needs way less land and other fewer inputs. So that's what's really needed. And it's starting to happen, but it's not happening nearly fast enough.
Do you think we'll see a predominantly plant-based world in our lifetime?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. It's hard for me to predict. I've been so wrong about so many predictions that I've made in the past. I'm always try to be a little bit humble with what I predict will happen. But I can tell you, I hope that's the case. Right now, we're going the opposite direction, honestly. This is just truth. We're not going in the right direction right now. Meat demand is going up, not down. But yes, I think it's possible. I think it will require a lot of resources, require a lot of money from investors, from the federal government, from state governments. But it's the only way that we have any chance of meeting our climate goals. You know, if we want to meet the climate goals set out in the Paris Agreement to try to limit warming to 1.5 Celsius of temperature increase, you can't do it without slashing the number of animals used for food. So necessity may become the mother of invention here.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you face in terms of scaling production and distribution of your product?
Definitely capital. You know, the actual production is not that expensive, but you have to build. You have to build factories that have lots of steel and concrete. And when you don't have revenue, it's hard to get people to loan you money. If you're a big company and you have a lot of free cash flow, you can get banks to loan you money so that you can expand. But if you're a startup that, you know, doesn't have that much revenue, it's very hard to gain access to tens of millions of dollars to do the capital expenditures needed to build massive fermentation systems. So I'd say access to capital is by far the biggest bottleneck for us, but we're working on it. We're working on it.
So do you spend a pretty good amount of your time personally on fundraising and looking for investment?
Yeah, that's the case. That's the case. And, you know, my goal is to find people who share our mission, people who are, you know, high net worth individuals who want to see the same type of future that we want to see, a future in which we can slash the reliance on animals for food. And I'd invite them to invest in that type of a future. That's what we can provide at the Better Meat Co.
So just a few months ago, actually, in November of 2022, the FDA cleared lab-grown chicken for sale to consumers. I know that there is a huge difference between FDA clearance and actual commercial viability. But what do you think is the future of lab-grown meat versus alternative meat products such as the ones that you're creating? Are they going to coexist, or is lab-grown meat going to be more of like a transition product to a future filled with fungi, or what do you think that looks like?
I was thrilled. It was a totally historic day when FDA did that. Here's my good joke about this. So why did the cultivated chicken cross the road? Because the FDA gave it the green light. Thank you for that. Look, it's going to be a long time before cultivated meat from animal cells is going to be on the market in a meaningful way. I do believe that it will be a big part of the future, but again, that's the future, not the present. Even though the FDA did this a few months ago, there's still 0 grams that are being sold. The USDA still hasn't cleared it, which is necessary. And even if they did today, came on and said they could sell it, the amount that would be sold is so small that it would be not even a rounding error of a rounding error. Now, of course, everything starts small. You know, like, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't have smartphones. You know, the first iPhone cost over $1 billion to build. Now we all have them in our pockets when we walk around. And so just because it's going to take time to ramp up does not mean that it can't ramp up. It's just going to take time. And so I don't view fungi or plants or cultivated meat as necessarily competitors of one another, as much as the wind and solar and geothermal are competitors. They're all part of the clean energy, or in this case, clean protein solution.
Yeah. So obviously you're much more ingrained in this kind of ecosystem than I am, but I believe that we're going to see a predominantly plant-based vegan world in our lifetime.
Great.
Or at least I have to hope that this is going to be the case. And I think that is largely driven by economics. And you've touched on that a little bit. What are the economics of the products you're working on versus some of these alternatives? And how do you see that playing out over the long term as you continue to increase your production capacity?
Well, right now, the animal-free meats are substantially more expensive than the animal-based meats. And yeah, that shouldn't be surprising because animal-based meats have been worked on for centuries and fed breeding programs to make animals grow faster, huge amounts of federal support and state support for their infrastructure, and so on. So it shouldn't be surprising. But I do think that as these companies scale, including ours, the Better Meat Co., but others like Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, that they will bring their prices down. And the CEO of Beyond Meat stated that their goal was to get down to commodity beef prices by 2025. So, you know, beef is a lot more expensive than chicken. So, you know, you got to keep that in mind. But if they can get down to beef prices by 2025, that would be pretty awesome. I think you have to beat it on price. I don't think it's just matching it that will do it. But I do think that that would be really amazing. I mean, my wife and I were at Safeway recently, and we saw Beyond Burgers. It was $5.99 for two patties. These are quarter pounders. So that's $12 a pound. You know, you're not talking like 30 or 40% over the cost of commodity meat there. You're talking like 300 or 400%. Over the cost. And so you got to be really motivated to want to buy it. You know, it's you got to be really motivated to want to buy that, to spend so much more for it. And so the question will be, like, how do you get that down? And that requires scale. It requires breeding. So, you know, if you could, for example, breed peas that had a higher percentage protein, you could bring the cost way down because you need to grow fewer peas. Whereas, you know, chickens have been selectively bred for centuries to grow really, really fast. And that makes chicken very, very cheap. And we've got to do that. So it's not just making it taste better. It's not just scaling. There's like a lot of science that needs to happen in order to make this a reality.
It seems like the unit economics of the work that you're doing over the long term at full scale would be highly competitive against a Beyond Meat or these other products. In fact, it seems like you would have almost a clear advantage in terms of your fundamental technology.
Yeah,
so
I agree. That's why I'm doing it. If I thought this was not going to be cost competitive, I wouldn't be spending my time on it. I totally agree. I think that instead of going big with animal agriculture, we should be going small with cellular agriculture and microbial agriculture. And that is why I'm doing this.
I was really interested to learn that the product you create is actually used to create hybrid meat products. So as I understand, what you're doing is you have meat companies who are purchasing your product and using it as some filler to blend it in with their meat products to create kind of a blended protein product. Is that accurate? Could you go into some detail about how that works?
Sure. So, you know, earlier in the interview, I said that we really love the F word, fungi. In this case, we don't really like the F word, filler, right? This is an enhancer. So I'll put it this way. You can use the microbial protein that we create for two things. You can make a totally animal-free meat, which is a great thing to do, or you can use it to hybridize your meat. And so you could imagine, for example, a company like Hormel Foods taking Spam and, you know, replacing some of the pork with our microbial protein. Now, vegans aren't going to want to eat that, but it'll be great for pigs because it means that the people who do eat Spam, which is, you know, far more than the number of vegans out there, are going to be eating fewer pigs. And so it's kind of like if you imagine hybrid cars, you know, they're not all electric, but they're better. It's better. And, you know, it would be, you know, I would love it if everybody went to electric, but it's still easier for people to buy hybrids today. And so because of that, I actually think that working with the big meat companies to help them use fewer animals is a great idea. The way that you described it, Leif, is accurate, that we sell them the microbial ingredient. They then add it to their products so they can, you know, have better nutrition, better texture, and a lower footprint on the planet. Now, if you think about, though, like what these big meat companies can do, like I look at it like, not like Kodak and Canon. You know, these are two huge film companies that were vying for supremacy back in the 1990s, and they both knew about digital. But it wasn't Kodak that pursued digital. They were afraid that digital was going to cannibalize its cool selling print film and print photos and all the chemicals you need for the dark rooms and all that. Whereas Canon thought, hey, this will cannibalize our core business. And they still did it. And now Canon is the number one manufacturer of digital cameras on the planet. And Kodak went bankrupt. And so you can see, like, there are some companies, there are some meat companies today that are more like Kodak. These are companies that have their head in the sand. They think that, you know, dipping their toe in the plant-based or non-animal world is going to be detrimental to them. They say, hey, we've been slaughtering animals for thousands of years, and so we're going to be slaughtering animals for 1,000 more years. But there's other ones that are more like Canon. They're more forward-thinking. And these are the ones that are investing in animal-free proteins. And I think it's really helpful to help these meat companies see that they can still have a business. you know, Canon still sells us the same thing, right? It's still capturing our memories, right? Like, you still take a photo to capture your memories. It's just way more efficient. You don't have to wait for the negatives to be printed and all that. And I could see Tyson and Hormel and Purdue and others still selling us the same meat experience in the future, but without animals. And so I like the idea that, you know, for example, you know, think about like Toyota, it's a regular internal combustion engine company, but they, you know, have been selling the Prius for like 20 years now as a hybrid and have really helped to advance hybrid technologies that are a nice transition to an all electric future. The same is so, I think, with meat companies, that if we can help them to see that they can still be in business, but just with fewer or no animals, it's a good thing.
I totally agree. I think anything that we can do to reduce the number of animals being slaughtered for food is a step in the right direction. Even if that doesn't mean that we have tons of people going vegan, at least taking steps in that direction is really helpful.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. So, you know, you could imagine a company, let's say like Tyson, both putting out a totally animal-free meat and taking their conventional meat and making it less animal. You know, this is, it's actually not that dissimilar to what we do with our gas right now. Like when you put gas in your car, you don't even think about it, but it's usually like 10 to 15% ethanol. And that's because, in the second Bush administration, they passed a renewable fuels standard, which mandates that, the gasoline that we use in our cars is blended with ethanol. Now there's a lot of debate as to what, you know, whether this is better for the planet or not, but the point is that, you know, we use a lot less oil, because of it. So what if the standard for animal-based meat became not all animal meat? What if it was hybridized? I think you could envision that type of a world, and it would mean billions of fewer animals being raised for food.
Yeah, I totally agree. So you call your main product Ryza, and that's a whole food, complete protein. That's what we've been talking about with what you're doing at the Better Meat Co. How do you define protein digestibility, and how does Ryza compare to its animal-based counterparts?
So digestibility is usually something that people think about when you're thinking about like how bioavailable is the amino acids in the foods. And so usually, you know, you just see on a product label and the nutrition facts is the number of grams of protein. But not all protein is equal. You know, you can have incomplete proteins and complete proteins. Complete meaning it has all 9 essential amino acids. We consider them essential because your body can't make them. So the 9 essential amino acids, if you have all of them in the food, then you don't need to worry because you're going to get them. Now, in the plant-based world, some of them, like leucine and lysine, as I mentioned earlier, aren't as widely distributed as they are in some animal foods. And so our product has all of the essential amino acids in them. So you don't need to worry whether you're getting all of those or not. Honestly, like protein deficiency is virtually non-existent in the United States. So people are not, you know, going around like dropping a dead of protein deficiency. Frankly, they're going around dropping dead of heart attacks, which, you know, is associated with high meat consumption. But it's important for some people to know that it's a complete protein and they don't have to worry about whether they're getting some of those more rare proteins in the plant-based world, amino acids in the plant-based world. So the way that you can look at this then is basically what's called PD-CAS, which is like a protein digestibility adjusted score. And that basically is a chart that you can look and see, like it's a 0 to 1 chart, 1 being the perfect protein distribution of the amino acids. And the only foods that are like that are like egg whites, and I think milk. And other foods though, you know, those are a 1.0 on the scale. And then if you look at something like beef, it's like a 0.92. So, you know, very, very high on the PD-CAS chart. Whereas our microbial protein is 0.96. So even more bioavailable than beef. You're getting the protein you want, you're getting the fiber that you need, and you get it in a way that tastes great. And so that's one of the real benefits of what we're doing. You know, I mentioned that protein deficiency is virtually non-existent in the United States. However, sadly, fiber deficiency is near universal. More than 90% of people don't get enough fiber. And fiber deficiency is associated with all types of ailments, not just constipation, though that's bad enough, but colon cancer and heart disease and other major killers of Americans are associated with fiber deficiency. Well, we know meat doesn't have any fiber at all. You know, the reason why animals have skeletons is because they don't have fiber. Plants have fiber. That's what holds them up. Plants and fungi use fiber to hold them up because they don't have skeletons, whereas animals have skeletons, and so we don't have fiber in our bodies. And so the only way that you're going to get fiber is by eating fungi or plants, not through meat. And so in this case, you basically have a microorganism that is essentially protein wrapped around fiber. I mean, it's the whole package. You get both the protein you want plus the fiber you need, again, in a way that tastes great. So that's among the many benefits of our product, is that you end up getting everything you want. It's like a true superfood.
Do you see your business being B2B through its whole scaling kind of journey, or do you envision some part of your company that becomes a B2C kind of?
You know, business models change, but our vision is a B2B ingredients play. You know, right now, if you look at like the pea protein makers, they're selling to Beyond, they're selling to numerous other companies. There's like, you know, think about like Cargill. It's like, you know, you go to Cargill, nobody thinks they're eating a Cargill product because it doesn't say Cargill on the label. But we're all eating Cargill products all the time because they're selling such a huge number of the ingredients in our food. I could envision the Better Miko growing into something like a Cargill, where it's an ingredient that's in tons of brands, but it's not something you see on the label.
So you've done multiple TED Talks. You've connected with billionaires, celebrities, world changers with your podcast and other kind of avenues. You've raised millions of dollars in venture capital for your company. What are some of your tips or secrets to networking, building relationships? It sounds like that's a pretty decent chunk of your time these days. What have you learned about that you could share with the audience?
One of the biggest problems that I find is that oftentimes people think about what they want rather than what other people want. And it's really important to recognize that nobody cares about what you want. Nobody. Like, really nobody. Only you do. And so it's not helpful to talk about anything that you want. It's helpful to think about what do other people want and are you able to provide that for them? And that could be as simple as somebody wanting a few better feature for animals. You know, that could be that. I want that too. But, you know, it could be somebody wanting a good return on their investment. It could be somebody who, you know, they want to be able to tell their friends that they're, you know, invested in this cool new sector. I mean, who knows, whatever their motivation may be. Maybe it's that their daughter is pressing them to do this because she thinks it's really important for animals or for climate change and they want to be able to, you know, satisfy their daughter. Like, it could be anything. I try to remember that nobody cares at all about your interests, basically. Nobody cares what you're interested in. They only care what they're interested in. And so it's important to get to know people, not in like a Machiavellian way, but in an authentic way, just to get to know people and learn, like, what is it that they're interested in? And most of the time, I find that I learn a lot from talking to other people because they know much more about certain topics than I do. And so by listening to them talk, I learn lots of really interesting things. For an example, we have a coworker of mine at the Better Miko who's a PhD in biology. He's a really smart guy, and he knows so much about evolution. And I'm very interested in evolution, but I know a tiny, minuscule fraction of what he knows. And so I'm constantly talking to him to get his insights about certain things that I wonder. And he's very helpful, really, really helpful on that. And I think that's just one example among many about a life lesson that I think has been useful for me.
Yeah, great advice. So you touched on this a little earlier, but entrepreneurship is hard. You wake up every day, get beat up. You got tons of highs and lows, but the highs are really high, the lows are really low, and it always seems like there are more lows than highs. And you, I heard you say this on a recent podcast episode. You said when you start your own company, you'll sleep like a baby. You'll wake up every 2 hours and cry, which I think is pretty accurate. So how do you handle the stress of the entrepreneur roller coaster?
Yeah. So first, let me give credit where credit is due. So I do use that quote, but I did not invent it. So Ben Horowitz, who's a venture capitalist, did say when you start your own company, you'll sleep like a baby because you wake up every 2 hours and cry. I love the quote. It's very resonant with me. I agree with everything you just said, Leif, which is, you know, there are highs and lows, but just to be frank, there are way more lows. I'll be very honest with you. Like, my personal welfare is lower than before the company, you know, like, it is a very hard thing to do. And it's just like, you're getting punched in the face every day. It's rare that things go right. It's just a really difficult thing to do. And I take solace in a number of things. One, I love the quote from the great philosopher Rocky Balboa, where he said that in life, it's not about how hard you can hit. It is about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. And that is how winning is done. So I think about that quite a lot. In fact, I have that framed on my wall, that quote. But I also think about other people who have faced really tremendously difficult circumstances and beat the odds and succeeded. Like if you read, for example, Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, the co-founder of Nike, and it's a great book that I highly recommend because he talks about all the ways that Nike nearly died, all the ways that he nearly failed. And of course, you know, he became a tremendous success, but I found it quite inspirational. Now, you know, does it make the world any better to have Nike? I don't know. We'll see how it makes the world better. But it's an impressive story of somebody who devoted his life to this and, you know, did very well. You know, not even in the business world, but look at somebody like Nelson Mandela, who was basically treated as a terrorist, went to prison for nearly 3 decades, only to emerge and become the president of his country. Like, what are the odds that somebody who's been in prison for nearly 3 decades emerges to become the president of his country and to end the regime of racial apartheid without having to fight a violent revolution? I mean, that is an incredible feat and extremely unlikely. Even the things I was talking about earlier about the eradication of slavery, you know, very unlikely given the tremendous history that humans have with enslaving each other. I'm reading this book right now. It's called The Alchemy of Air. It's about the invention of synthetic fertilizer. And basically before synthetic fertilizer, before the Haber-Bosch process, you know, guano was a major industry. You were shipping huge amounts of guano from Latin America, mainly Peru, to the rest of the world to fertilize fields. And I'm like, I was thinking, man, who's scooping all this guano? It turns out a bunch of Chinese slaves are the ones scooping it, like in the 1870s. And so they just had a bunch of Chinese slaves down in Peru. It was horrible. Their lives were just, it's just absolutely terrible. So anyway, you know, slavery, you know, we like to think of it as like an abnormal thing, but, you know, it's pretty normal for a long time, sadly. And so these type of stories are what give me inspiration. The fact that many people have triumphed against tremendous odds to come back. And that is how I deal with the constant frustration and the constant suffering that doing this causes. Because I think if we succeed, it will be a tremendous contribution to the world. I would not be doing this if it was just a way to make money. There's lots of ways you can make money. This would not be the easiest one to do. But if we succeed, I truly believe that we can prevent millions and maybe even billions of animals from undergoing the factory farming system, which would be, you know, a great reason to live and to die. And so that's how I think about it is, the jackpot is so lucrative that it's worth the effort in the meantime.
I relate to all of that so much. And Shoe Dog is actually my favorite book of all time. I've lost count of how many times I've read it. It's been over 30. I listen to it every few months.
Cool.
And it's a phenomenal book. I don't know how much maybe... I had actually our whole team read it just 2 months ago. So that was a really fun experience. They all loved it. So I think pretty much anybody who takes the time to read or listen to that book would take something from it. But especially I think if you're an entrepreneur and you're just constantly feeling beat up like we're talking about, which is a daily occurrence, I think there's a lot of wisdom and inspiration that you can draw from Phil Knight and the founding of Nike.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great book. That's so cool. I've only read it once, not 30 times, but I did love it.
Yeah, it's great. So last question, clearly you've let passion guide your career. You just touched on the meaning of this mission and why this really matters so much to you. What advice would you give to someone who is trying to find that in their life? They're trying to find direction in their life and they're trying to find really what their mission is.
I think about this a lot. It's funny you mentioned this, Leif, because I was just talking about this with a friend that I find that many people who I meet, I kind of liken them to like they're on a raft and there's no rudder, you know, like they're just whatever way that wind or the ocean currents take them, they just go that direction. And I have found much more purpose and meaning in my life by having a North Star to which I am going. which is trying to, you know, slash the number of animals used for food in order to reduce an enormity of suffering in the world. And it's been something that has animated my life now for 3 decades. And I imagine that if I live another 3 decades, that will still continue to be the case. And so not everybody is going to be motivated for the same thing. Somebody else may think, I really want to get us off of oil and gas. Or they may think, I really want to find a solution to the plastics problem, to create biodegradable plastics, or a way to degrade current plastics so that we don't have to just let them pile up in the oceans or in landfills. Or maybe somebody wants to figure out how do we make nuclear energy more realistically safe. It's an amazing carbon-free way to produce energy, but obviously it's, there have been high-profile accidents. What if there are ways to really cut down on that? So you go into nuclear engineering. Or people who want to find better ways to make sugars that don't spike people's glycemic index, but still give you the sensation of sweetness in your mouth without negative side effects. That could also reduce a lot of suffering. People who, have all these types of health ailments associated with a high sugar diet. So I think there's lots of ways to make the world a better place. The thing is, I would wonder, what motivates you? What is your driving passion? I just named about 6 problems that can be solved by businesses. But maybe there's something else that you think is the thing that you really want to do and you want to devote your life to it. Phil Knight wanted to create a new running shoe. It's not really what would get me out of bed in the morning, but for him, that's what it was. And so, success requires focus. It requires persistence. It requires you oftentimes to fail and get back up again and to keep moving forward. And so I would just think, if I were not doing this, I think, what is the biggest way that I can make an impact that I will be zealously devoted to? Because it's so easy to give up. It's so easy to walk away. You see it all the time. All the time you see it. People leave their companies, but co-founders break up and so on. It's such an easy path to take because the going gets very tough. And so you have to have something that you're really, zealously devoted to. And if I were an investor, that's what I would be looking for. Not somebody who just merely wanted to make money, but somebody who really wanted to devote their lives to this. Tim Draper, who's a legendary venture capitalist, has a line where he says that he likes to back missionaries, not mercenaries. If somebody's just trying to make a quick buck, they're not likely to stick with it when the going gets tough. So that's my main thinking on this is pick something that you have a almost religious-like devotion to solving this problem, and you'll figure out ways to make it happen.
Yeah, I love that. Steve Jobs said something similar when he said something along the lines of, if you don't, you have to absolutely love what you're doing, because if you don't, you're going to give up. No rational person is going to continue beating themselves up, especially if you're an entrepreneur, someone who's trying to make a really big impact in the world. It's so tough. And if you don't absolutely love what you're doing, you're going to give up, because it's so hard. Yeah. So, Paul, really appreciate your time. You've been so gracious with your time, and I really appreciate it. How can our audience best support your work?
Oh, that's so kind of you, Leif. It's really a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for all you're doing to help promote plant-based eating. First and foremost, if you're interested in my book, you can go to cleanmeat.com. You can also get the book anywhere books are sold, including Amazon. But the official website for the book is cleanmeat.com. If you're interested in the Better Meat Code, check us out at bettermeat.co. Again, that's bettermeat.co, and you can get in touch with us through the website there. And if you're interested in my own podcast, it's called the Business for Good Podcast, where we feature companies that are making money by making the world a better place. And that's at businessforgoodpodcast.com.
Thank you so much. I started checking out some episodes of your podcast. It is phenomenal.
I appreciate
that. And I love the structure and idea of the podcast. So I look forward to catching up on a bunch of other episodes. So again, thank you so much for your time, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Leif, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed my conversation with Paul Shapiro. Despite some of the bleak trends in worldwide meat consumption that Paul pointed out, I am extremely optimistic about our future. I firmly believe that in the coming decades, we will create a world where meat consumption is akin to smoking in today's world. Very few people, I believe, will consume slaughtered animals a few decades into the future. Our future is very bright, but it is up to us to ensure that bright future becomes a reality. So thank you so much for being part of our mission to help 1 million vegans get into the best shape of their lives. Together, we are spreading compassion, challenging the status quo, and fueling the vegan revolution. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode. To get access to some of our best content for free, head over to thevegangym.com. We've got tons of articles and guides to help you burn stubborn body fat, build lean muscle, and supercharge your health. You can even use our vegan nutrition calculator for free to figure out how much protein, calories, and micronutrients your body needs. Get started right now at thevegangym.com.